Good morning, Grove. I hope you're well today. Are you? That's good on this rainy day. None of you are melting. That's probably a good sign, don't you think? Back in 2001, our family had the trip really of a lifetime. I had a speaking engagement over in Europe in Germany. Church that we were serving in Phoenix had missionaries all over. And one of those couples was in Germany, so we were supporting the couple in the church that they had founded in Hereford, Germany. Brenda and I went over, and we were there to do some preaching and leadership training and organization stuff. And when that was done, Brenda and I got on a train, took it over to Frankfurt, and went through the Rhine Valley, which was absolutely amazing. In Frankfurt, the next day, we met our kids and my mom and my dad. They flew over and met us there. And then we took 2 weeks to move through Germany and Italy. I mean, the things we saw were just absolutely amazing. There's just no other way to say it. We were in Rodenburg, which is like a Christmas village. It's where, if you've done any of this research, Kathy Wolfart is her big story. I mean, it's kind of on forever, Christmas story. We spent 3 days in Munich. We saw Ludwig's castles. We went to the Eagle's Nest, which was the Nazi party's gift to Hitler on his 50th birthday. We took a train down to Venice. We were in Venice. We spent several days in Florence. We saw David's statue, Michelangelo's statue of David. We were in Rome for 4 or 5 days. We, you know, saw the Colosseum. We were in the Vatican. We were in the Vatican Museum. We were in the Sistine Chapel. Gretchen was in awe of that place, and she's told me several times that she has a bunch of ideas for the ceiling in here if I'll just get her a, you know, scaffolding system. But anyway, it was really unbelievable to be with our fairly young kids at that point, and, you know, teenagers, and my mom and dad. My mom died just 2 years later, so at 64. So it turns out that it was really just a perfect time. Because of our family's German and Jewish heritage, we wanted to make sure that our kids' eyes were open to the things that were happening in Germany back in the 30s and 40s, specifically pertaining to the Holocaust. And that took us to Dachau, which was a camp which was outside of Munich, 40, 45 minutes outside. Now, Dachau was not a death camp, an extermination camp for Jews. What it was a concentration camp, and it was for German dissenters. If you were in Germany and you were a political adversary to Hitler, to the Nazi regime, this is where you ended up. They would take you. And so lots of high-powered people, educators and, you know, CEOs and pastors, a lot of those people wound up at Dachau. Now, don't miss the truth. It wasn't an extermination camp, but it most absolutely was a death camp. If you were there and you were there for any length of time, you were going to die. You were going to be starved. You were going to die. And it was just a horribly wicked place. The labor that you were forced to do, a place where medical experimentation was going on. We walked through some of that and saw some of what they were doing. It's just hard to believe. Torture that was unbelievably inhumane, and the living conditions. I mean, the camp was made for like 5,000 people, and as it grew and grew and grew, there was supposed to be one person in a bunk. They were putting 6 or 8 people in a bunk. Literally, they slept on their sides, literally front to back to front to back to front to back. And a German soldier would come in the middle of the night and blow a whistle, and then everybody would roll over. I mean, you couldn't even move in your bunk without everybody around you moving as well. Dachau was horrible. It was liberated on August 29th, 1945. Allied troops had swooped into Germany, and they made their way to the camp. And as the Allied forces got to the camp, they began to see firsthand what had been happening. There was a lot of rumors going around, but now cameras were coming out and photographs were being taken. And I'm telling you, it was absolutely shocking. There was an outcry, a worldwide outcry. And this was before satellites and, you know, before 24-hour news stations. This is when, you know, information would take days, sometimes weeks, to get around the world. I mean, the world saw this stuff, and it was aghast. And not just an outcry about what was going on at Dachau. Well, it was the uncovering of the Holocaust and the 6 million Jewish people that had been murdered. People worldwide were screaming. So much so that a series of military tribunals were held in Nuremberg. And many of you maybe have read about this, or some of you even were living at that time. The Nazi leaders were rounded up as much as they could get these guys. They were tried and convicted, and many of them were executed for their crimes against humanity. And that outcry that came against the Nazi regime should have been the exact same outcry that happened when Jesus was arrested. If Fox and CNN had been there 2,000 years ago and had, you know, the satellite ability, I'm sure we would have been seeing this firsthand, and people would have been screaming about it. The injustice of the arrest, the trials, the conviction of Jesus was absolutely alarming. And let me just tell you, it was nothing to what was coming. The injustice of what Jesus was getting ready to suffer literally was just beginning through his trials. And from the moment Jesus was turned over to be crucified, things only escalated to new depths of depravity. I want to put a couple of thoughts in front of you. Please write them down. And it begins with the setup. Jesus was condemned, and now what needed to happen was the Romans need to get him on the cross. The fact that Jesus was innocent is well documented. Pilate announced 3 separate times in the course of this discourse that he found Jesus innocent. I find no basis of any kind of fault in him. But Pilate was threatened, as we talked about last week. His job was procurator governor of Palestine. He was working under the authority of Rome and carrying out Rome's wishes, and as that person, he was in charge of keeping the peace. And the Jews were a difficult lot to govern, because the Jews did believe that nobody should be governing over them. They believed they were God's people, and they should have their own king sitting on their own throne, and so they took exception to anybody that was trying to have any kind of rule or authority over them. And because of that, they were constantly in an uproar, constantly up in arms. Palestine was a hotbed of discontent. Now, rumor had it that Pilate was on his last leg. One more riot in your region, in your district, one more, you're done. You're done. And what that meant was he was going to die. Matthew 27, 24 says, with his pronouncement of Jesus being innocent for the third time, by the way, that an uproar was starting again. Pilate's worst nightmare was happening right before his eyes. And so instead of standing up for justice, instead of being the man he should have been, instead of saying, stop it, knock it off, and bringing out the guards and putting a halt to all of this, Pilate called for a basin of water. And there in front of the crowd, he washed his hands of the whole thing. His declaration was, I'm innocent of this man's blood. It's your responsibility. The Jewish leadership was more than happy to take it. They said, great, his blood could be on our head and on our kids' heads too. Great. And with that, Jesus was handed over to be crucified. Everything is going to move quickly now. The soldiers took charge of Jesus' execution. And I want you to remember that Jesus had already been through a huge amount of abuse. Huge. And as he was abused, he was emotionally spent. He was already emotionally spent. Remember the garden? Sweating blood. To be at that point where you're under so much strain and stress that the capillaries under your skin are literally bursting and blood is coming through your pores, it just represents the stress that Jesus was under. He did not want to do this. He knew what it meant. He knew what it represented. He knew what it was going to cost. He knew the pain. He didn't want to do it. I'm sure you've been in some of those kind of stressful situations, maybe not to that degree, but you know, like I do, that when you are under that kind of pressure, it is just exhausting. And then you add to the emotional stress the desertion of the disciples. I mean, when Jesus was arrested, they just fled. You can understand, they believed that they were next. If they could do this to him, we're counted with him. They're coming after us. And Jesus knew it was going to happen. He had already said that he knew what Judas was going to do. He already said that he knew what Peter was going to do, which was Peter's getting ready to do, deny him 3 times. But even in spite of knowing that, it wouldn't have been any less painful. Jesus is literally left all alone. And so imagine the emotional strain and pressure and stress of the cross, and then to realize that you're all alone. And then on top of that, there was a complete injustice of the trials. You know that when you're being treated unfairly, it can be exhausting. The Jewish leadership, Pilate, Herod, Pilate, everybody callously running him down this road. It was wrong. And that was just the beginning. Not only was he emotionally spent, he was physically spent as well. You remember what has already happened to him. Physically, he's running on little sleep. He's been up for at least 24 hours now. And I'm sure that the nights coming towards this one were nights that were not characterized by a lot of sleep. I can only imagine that knowing what was coming, and he knew full well. In fact, 10 days earlier, as they were coming towards Jerusalem, he stopped with his disciples and he told them exactly what's happening. We're going to Jerusalem. I'm going to be arrested. I'm going to be convicted. I'm going to die. And then I'm going to rise from the dead. He knew what was coming days out. I'm sure at this point, sleep is hard to find. He was struck in the face by Jewish officials at the high priest's house. He was flogged. Point is that when Jesus got to the verdict of condemnation, he had already been through a heavy weight of abuse, but it was just the beginning. A few things to note here. Letter A, the abuse is going to be added to abuse. There's going to be further abuse. When Jesus was handed over to the guards to be crucified, a whole new level of abuse started. Matthew 27 through 31 tells us. They stripped him. They put a robe on him. They weaved together from a thorn bush. And don't think of little rose thorns. I've seen the thorns that they probably used. They were like razor sharp needles that were probably 3, 4, 5 inches long. They weaved together a crown. They jammed it into his head. They took a rod. They put it into his hand. And now with this robe on, they're all, these soldiers are now mocking him as they bow on their knees in front of him saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." Then they take the staff out of his hand and they start beating him on the head with it. They spit on him. Have you ever been spit on? Mark 14:65 tells us that they blindfolded him. And now that he's blindfolded, they're punching him in the head, in the face. It'd be one thing to know that a punch was coming and to be able to sort of kind of turn. Jesus has no way to even know. These guys are punching him, blindfolded, and then they're laughing at him. Prophesy, prophesy. Who's the one that hit you? You know, the amazing thing is he knew exactly who hit him. He could have struck him dead. He took it. You got to see broken bones. You've got to see teeth knocked out. It wasn't enough that Jesus was going to be killed. It wasn't enough that he'd already been flogged, that he would be nailed to a cross. Their goal was to completely humiliate him. And when they were done with their fun, they began the walk to the cross, the journey to the place of execution. The place of death would have been right outside the gates of the city. The Romans always picked a very prominent spot to execute people. They were trying to make a point. You mess with us, this is what could happen to you. I'm telling you, it'd be a pretty convincing argument. You know what I mean? Nobody would want that to happen to them. And so what would the Romans would do is they would find a spot right outside the city gates, a prominent promontory, hopefully like a hill of some kind, where they could put people on so people coming and going from the city could see what was going on. A well-traveled road, a place where hundreds, if not thousands of people, in the city of Jerusalem, tens of thousands of people could see what was going on and to be reminded of the importance of submission to Rome. Here's what the Bible says about the crucifixion spot of Jesus. Matthew 27:33, they came to a place called Golgotha. Golgotha. Say that with me. Golgotha. Come on, say it again. Golgotha. It means the place of the skull. There's several spots right out outside the city gates of Jerusalem that could have been the spot. But there's one that has drawn attention. According to the description here in Matthew 27, it looks like this. It's about a half a mile from the place that Jesus would have been in the praetorium with the guards as they were having their way with him. I don't know if this is the spot, because it's actually a little bit further outside the city gates and a little bit up the road. But it sure gives an eerie feeling, because right here on the side of this hill looks to be a face or skull. Can you see it? I put some circles here, and then I want to take the circles away. So next slide, if you would. Can you sort of see it? Golgotha. The spot on the road going north out of Jerusalem, kind of on the road to Galilee or on the road to Samaria, would have been a place that Jesus would have been seen from a half a mile away. And what you have to know is, to get there, they didn't cart him. They didn't put him in a chariot and take him. He had to walk. You think about that. The weariness, the tiredness, the emotional. He had to be in some kind of shock. All the blood loss, all the abuse physically. So they're going to take him. Which meant he needed to move first through the streets of Jerusalem. And I'm just telling you, that would be no easy task. The streets were narrow places. Jerusalem is built up in the hills, almost like mountainous territory. It would have been up and down and up and down, and lots of stairs. And then you add two more very difficult things to this journey. The first would have been the crowds. The crowds would have gathered in kind of a sick, twisted way to see this. And from there, you have jeering and spitting and laughing and pushing and throwing stuff at the condemned. They would have literally been pressing around him. I mean, like close enough to touch him, close enough to push him. And on top of all of this, with the weary, beat-up state of Jesus, he's now carrying the weight of a cross. Now, in traditional pictures, we see him with the full cross, the cross beam and the vertical piece that would hold it up. It's probably not how it happened. That would have weighed 300 or 400 pounds. There's no way that Jesus could. It wasn't like on a cart on rollers. It would have had to be drug up and down. There's probably no way that happened. What Jesus probably carried was the cross beam, and I'm just telling you, that was probably way more than enough. It probably weighed 75 to 125 pounds. Just think about the state he would be in, and then adding that onto his shoulders, trying to figure out how to climb up and down. What we do know is that he got to a point where he was so spent, so far gone, he couldn't take another step. The Roman guards lovingly grabbed a guy, Simon of Cyrene, out of the crowd. They put the cross bar onto his shoulders, and he and Jesus move forward. Some place between a quarter and a half a mile outside the city gates now, we get to Golgotha. And at this point, things would have even sped up more quickly. First, the condemned would be laid down. They'd take the crossbeam, they would fix it to the vertical post, and as that is done, by either tying it together or nailing it together, now the condemned is thrown down onto the cross. Matthew 27:34 says they offered Jesus wine to drink. It was mixed with gall. But after tasting it, Jesus refused to drink it. What this mix was kind of almost like an anesthetic. It was intended to kind of dull people's senses. It would make it easier for the Romans to do to Jesus what needed to be done, or to any criminal, because they're going to be less likely to fight. I mean, if there's someone's getting ready to drive a nail into me, I believe me, with the last ounce of strength that I have, I'm going to fight it. So they take this and they give it to Jesus, but when he put his tongue to it, he refused it. And the reason? He didn't want his senses dulled. He wanted to be fully cognizant, fully coherent of everything that was getting ready to happen to him. And with that, they nailed him to the cross. The spikes were huge. Think railroad spikes. Don't think little 16-penny nails. Think railroad spikes. I have one in a box. It's packed away in my book in the other end. Church, I went looking for it a couple days ago, and it's in a box. I can't find it, but I have one. It's frightening. And they were driven first through the hands. And when you hear hands, think wrists. You put a nail right here, it's just going to rip out. You have two bones that are running through your forearm, the ulna and the radius. If you take one of those right into here and drive that nail, it's going to lock between those two bones, and it's going to make fastening to the cross an easier thing. They nail one wrist in, and then they move to the other side with Jesus down. They now have him where they take his arm and they lay it. Probably the Roman guard at this point is probably putting his hand into his chest and pulling, almost to the point of pulling his arm out of socket so he can get it over here, and the same thing happens. I mean, just imagine, the nerves running through here are going to cause a pain that you can't even begin to imagine. That a third spike is taken, it's driven into his feet. One of two things happened. They either overlapped his feet and it went right through the tops of your feet, or they would wrench you sideways and drive it right through your ankles. Imagine that. They probably affixed a little pedestal for the condemned to stand on there so that it wasn't all the weight on that nail, although most of it was. There would be a little bit of a bend in the knee. And then with the body firmly attached to the cross, they would hoist him up. They'd hoist him up and they would drop him down. They would do it this way because it'd be easier. You think, you know, get the cross up and put him on. No, then it's all these guys having to hold the condemned on. So no, it's easier on the ground to get it done. We can hoist him up. So see all these burly soldiers now getting under the cross. They've got some ropes. When it gets to a certain point, those ropes are going to be able to pull him up. And now there's probably a 3 or 4 foot hole in the ground that they're going to like slide him over, and then they're going to just drop him. They're not going to be gentle about this. So just imagine being fastened with these three nails and that 3 or 4 foot fall into the hole. Just imagine the pain. See all of the back that's lacerated already, to the point, as we talked last week, that lots of times you could literally see organs from the flogging and all of that rubbing against this rough-hewn cross, dropped in a hole. Wedges are knocked in to hold the cross up. Nothing gentle here. And now that Jesus is on the cross, a soldier would climb a ladder and nail a board or a piece of vellum to the top of the cross. It would have been letter E. It would have been the charge. The charge. Above the head of all of the condemned was a charge. Let's flip the slide forward if we could. Or we can't. Can we put the slide? Yeah, there we go. There we go. Why are we killing you? Here's it. Here it is. Matthew 27:37 says, above his head they placed the written charge. This is Jesus, King of the Jews. Well, that's something to kill somebody over. The crazy thing is, it's true. He is king. He is king over these. In fact, he's king over everybody. He's king of the Romans. He's king of the Greeks. He's king of kings and lords of lords. Come on, church. Amen, right? This is who he is. He's proven who he is. He's worthy to be honored, worthy to be worshipped. And he allowed himself to be hung up on this cross. As he said in the garden to Peter, put the sword away. I could have called thousands of angels and swooped down in this place and put an end to this right now. It's happening because this is God's will. It's been allowed to happen. And as soon as he's up there and this charge gets nailed in, it leads straight to a reaction from everybody who's standing around. The goal of the crucifixion was not just death. It was also a complete humiliation of the victim. And that's this point here, the humiliation. Now, the humiliation came in a couple of ways. First, there's a good chance that Jesus was naked on the cross. Think about that. It'd be one thing to have to die. It'd be one thing to have to be nailed to a tree, but now we're going to strip you. Joyful. If not, he would have been in some kind of skimpy loincloth. The whole point is he was exposed. And second, now that he's up, the charge is on, now the mocking starts. You would think that people would react differently. I mean, seriously. You know, like bow their heads and say a prayer. Like, I mean, this guy's got not very long to live. You know, Lord, you know, help him. Help him to take the steps he needs to take. You know, pray, do something. Shout a word of encouragement, do something. But that's not, no. Crucifixion brought out the worst in people, and it came from three places. Matthew 27 says, first it came from people that were just passing by. They're the people that are walking up the road. They're seeing this. It's meant to be a deterrent from you messing with Rome, and they're seeing this, and now they're calling out. You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down. I mean, Jesus' fame had obviously spread. He did say this thing. He wasn't talking about the literal temple. He's talking about his body, the temple of his body. It's you destroy this temple, I'll raise it up in 3 days. You know, they're laughing at him. They're making fun. He's going to prove it to be true on Sunday. And then there were the chief priests, the teachers of the law. These guys who had arrested him had falsely accused him, falsely tried him, trumped up, led this whole thing, screamed, yelled, threatened Rome. They should have been hanging on the cross, but here's Jesus, and now they're mocking him. He saved others. He saved others, but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down from the cross. If he does, if he can get himself down, then we'll believe it. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now. If God even wants him, for he said, I'm the Son of God. I mean, they believe that he's committed blasphemy. He's proven that he is who he's claimed to be. These guys are just cruel. And honestly, as they're standing here laughing and mocking and spitting at him, they think they've won. But probably for me, the most shocking of all the insults that come hurling at Jesus come from the two thieves that are hanging next to him. Matthew 27, verse 44 says, in the same way the robbers who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. I mean, if you're in that position, don't you think you have better things to think about than laughing at the guy in the middle? But it didn't stop. They joined in the chorus of mock. And now with Jesus officially on the cross, the clock is ticking. It's just a matter of time. And it leads to the next point, death. Death on a cross. How did it happen? All that Jesus had been through physically, he was now in excruciating pain. His body would have been sagging against the nails that were in his wrists. His weight, gravity, pulling him down. Major nerves have been hit. You can go online and read from medical experts about what this would have been. Pain would have been just piercing up in through his hands, into his fingertips, and then up through his arms, into his chest. And as he pushed up on his feet, which he needed to do to breathe and to try to alleviate some of this pain in his wrists, then the same thing is happening with pain shooting down to his toes and into up his legs. And as he was dealing with that pain, another phenomenon began to occur. His arms fatigued, and then they would cramp. And that cramping would begin to sweep over all the muscles of his arms and into his chest. They would have been knotting in deep, unrelenting, throbbing pain. Have you ever had a cramp in your foot when you're laying in bed? Has it ever happened to you? Happens to me all the time. And you know, it's like there and it hits, and you know, your foot like cramps up and it just, I mean, it gets into weird positions. You know, all your toes go, you know what I'm talking about? And it just hurts. and you try to straighten it out and it just makes it worse. You got to jump out of bed and get pressure on it. And you know what I mean? That's what's going on. And it's going on through his arms into his chest. It's just completely cramping. They hit somebody who's being crucified. Makes it nearly impossible to breathe. You can suck air in, but you can't push it out. Have you ever been hit in the solar plex? And you can like, and you can't get it out? That's Jesus right here. To get the air out, he would have to push up. So pain into his feet as he's trying to push up. Think of his lacerated back as he's pushing up against this rough-hewn piece of timber, and he's pushing up so he can exhale. And now, with pain gripping his feet and his legs, he allows himself to sag back down. So, and as he takes a breath in, six excruciating hours. So how did a person die on a cross? Death came by asphyxiation. You literally would suffocate. You got to a point where you were too cramped, too tired, and too much pain. You couldn't push yourself up anymore. And with no air coming into your lungs, your body's not being fed, pretty quickly your heart's going to stop. You're going to die. And this, because of asphyxiation, this is why legs were broken. John 19 tells us that it was the day of preparation. The next day was to be a special Sabbath. Because the Jews did not want the bodies left on the cross during the Sabbath, they asked Pilate to have the legs broken and the bodies taken down. The soldiers therefore came and broke the legs of the first man, criminal, who had been crucified with Jesus, and those of the other. Now, the day of preparation literally is the day before Sabbath. It'd be Friday. And on the Jewish calendar, the Jewish timetable, the new day did not start at midnight like it does for us. It started at sundown. So if you're thinking 6 or 7 in the evening at this time of year, because they didn't have daylight savings time, that means that when sun goes down, it's Saturday, it's the Sabbath. And no well-respecting Jew wants his city to be defiled because there are criminals on a cross. Aren't these sweet people? And so they went to the Roman governor and says, we don't want this going on outside of our holy city on the Sabbath day, so can you do something about it? So you die by asphyxiation, by suffocation. So if you break legs, then you can't push up anymore, so it's pretty quick. So at about 3 in the afternoon, they start breaking legs. Just see a big mallet coming up into your knees, whack! First criminal, the second criminal. But when they got to Jesus, he's already dead. John 19:33. So they did not break his legs. I don't know if you know this or not, but this was prophesied. Psalm chapter 34, 20. David is writing, and David's writing this 1,000 years before this event occurred. He had never seen a crucifixion. The Roman government didn't exist in those days. David's writing under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. He says he protects all his bones. Not one of them will be broken. David's writing it, not even knowing what he's writing, but everybody, all theologians, all scholars believe that this is completely messianic. It's describing this scene 1,000 years in advance. So at this point, we know that Jesus is dead. And one more thing. If that's not enough, a guard takes a spear and he gives him one final shot right in to the rib cage. I don't know why the soldier felt the need to do this, but he did. And with that, the crucifixion is complete. The Roman guards had set out and accomplished what they were supposed to accomplish. The religious leaders got what they wanted. Jesus is dead. Good riddance to him. But it raises one more critically important question, and this is it. Was Jesus really dead? And when you think through all that he's been through. I mean, it's almost comical. It's like it's a ridiculous question that anybody would ask this, but it's really not. Because here's the deal. If Jesus didn't really die, it means he really didn't rise from the dead. You hear that? And if that's true, if Jesus really didn't rise from the dead, then everything we believe and everything we hold to be true is just false and a sham. Because if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then the Bible is a lie, and he is not who he claimed to be, and it didn't happen how he said it was going to happen, which means he's not of God, which he's not a prophet of God, which means he's not God. Forget all that. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 15, and we'll look at it next week, that if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then everything we believe is futile. We just ought to all go home. Because we're still in our sins and we're all going to hell. So we have to raise the question, did Jesus really die? And the answer to that is yes. So the question is there any evidence that Jesus was really dead? And you know what? The answer to that is yes as well. Jesus was really dead. Really quickly, let me put five proofs in front of you that show without a shadow of a doubt that he was absolutely dead. Number one, the Roman soldiers. Or letter A. The Roman soldiers, here's the deal. These guys were experts at what they did. These guys were trained to do what they did. And this wasn't something that happened, you know, once or twice a year. This happened every day. It was happening three times on this one day outside of Jerusalem. On any given city in Rome, there could be hundreds of people hanging on crosses at any given time around the Roman Empire. These guys were pros at what they were doing. They knew what they were doing. When they pronounced you dead, you were dead. And listen, they were cruel to boot. If there was any chance that Jesus was alive, they would have broken his legs right along with the other thieves. And one more thing. Here's the truth. If they had messed up, if they took a man who was dead, down, who was alive, down from the cross, they would have been hung up on a cross. There's no way these guys are going to make that mistake. The Roman soldiers proved that Jesus was dead. And letter B, Pilate proves that he was dead. Pilate had to be convinced. Death on a cross could take days. There are accounts of people hanging on crosses for multiple days around the Roman Empire. Here in Jerusalem, probably your worst shot is like 6 days. Because if it's preparation day, they're gonna break your legs because they don't want you on the cross. But around the Roman Empire, people could hang here for days. Days. But Jesus died in 6 hours. He was on the cross at 9 a.m. At 3 p.m, he was dead. And Joseph of Arimathea asked Pilate for the body of Christ. And when Joseph sent word to Pilate saying, I would like his body, Pilate was taken back. So he made an inquiry. Mark chapter 15, 44 says, Pilate was surprised to hear that he was already dead. Summoning the centurion, he asked if Jesus had already died. When he learned from the centurion that it was so, he gave the body to Joseph. The centurion would have been the guy kind of in charge of the soldiers here. He's the one that has the greatest command. He's called in. There is no chance that this guy is going to let this go. And Pilate, there's no chance. After everything that Pilate has been through with the threat of the Jews and what they're going to do if Jesus isn't killed, there's no way that Pilate is going to let this go. Do you hear what I'm saying? Did Jesus die? The answer is yes. It's proven so by the soldiers. It's proven by Pilate. And third, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but it's proven by the Jewish leaders as well. Don't miss their acquiescence here. Letter C. Don't miss it. These guys have been working for 2 years to get Jesus dead. There is no way they're going to just let Jesus off that cross until they were absolutely convinced that he is good and dead. The fact that there is no protest, there's the fact that not one of these guys is following the centurion into Pilate's courtyard, into Pilate's hall, and is the centurion says, yeah, he's dead, and there's not one Jew that's saying, oh, no, he's not. You leave him up there. Break his legs. No, they all knew he was dead. And a fourth proof, letter D, modern cardiology would say he was dead as well. When that spear went into Jesus' side, it was significant. John chapter 19, verse 34 says, the soldier pierced Jesus' side with a spear, bringing a sudden flow of blood and water. The heart is surrounded by a sac. It's called the pericardium. In that sack, there's a liquid. And that serous liquid kind of forms like a shock absorber around your heart. And when your body is under trauma, that fluid will generate into that sac and will literally expand it and put pressure onto your heart. I mean, it's not an uncommon thing. So when that spear went through Jesus' side, the fact that there was blood and water flowing, the serous solution that is coming out is that solution in the pericardium between the heart and that outer shell. That spear is going right in and releasing that watery substance out, and then it's going right into the middle of the heart. So blood inside the heart is now flowing out too. Cardiologists will tell you, oh, if he wasn't dead already, he's dead now. And one last proof, and that'd be the burial. And I'm not just saying the fact that they buried him. There's stories of people getting buried alive. But if he was not dead at this point, the burial would have finished him. Some have speculated that Jesus really wasn't dead on the cross, that he came off the cross still alive. And then their statement is that he revived over 36 hours, you know, then got himself out of his grave clothes and rolled that stone away and appeared before the Roman guard and scared them all, and they all ran off. You know, then he appeared before all of his followers saying, I'm alive. I mean, nobody would have believed that. Not so, it's just crazy. His body has been ravished. The cool tomb would have never been able to revive him. Besides, he'd been completely depleted of liquids. If there was any chance that he was going to be brought back to life at this point, it wouldn't have been because of this cold, unattended tomb. He needed emergency care. He needed fluids. He needed IVs. He wasn't going to get any of that. And the body being prepared for burial by his followers, I mean, even if there was only a shallow breathing, don't you think the women, don't you think Joseph of Arimathea, Nicodemus, don't you think that these guys would have noticed that? And let's just say they didn't. Let's just say it went unnoticed. I'm just telling, the burial prep would have done it as well. John 19:39 says, Nicodemus brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds of spices, to spread on his body. It was to help with the stench of decay. They all thought he was dead. They poured those 75 pounds of spices. If you had 75 pounds of stuff ever put on your chest, it's not easy to breathe. Wherever he was at this point, if there's any even shallow, it's gone, because now they're going to mummy wrap him. It's going to be tight. He's there. He's in the grave. He's on the shelf. I'm telling you, he is gone. There's only one way to see this. Jesus died, and he was buried. And it was all for you. All for you. His life for your life. The punishment of your sin on his shoulders. He became the sacrifice of atonement. Romans 3, 25, 26. He was the offering that turned away God's wrath, turned it away from you and onto him. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, my God, why have you forsaken me? He became the anathema of God as he accepted the consequence of the sin of the world as it was laid on his shoulder. You want to talk about stress and pain? All of the emotional pain, all of the physical pain, all of that compared nothing to the fact that he was now separated from his Father because of my sin. Some friends, forgiveness comes at a price, a heavy price, at the price of the death of God on a cross. Did Jesus die? The answer is. Did he die for me? The answer is yes. Bow your heads. Would you do that? And friends, I want you to take it in. I want to encourage you to not move lightly whatever's pressing through your minds right now, take it and push it away. Let your mind be absorbed in this thought, and this thought alone. That cross existed because of my sin. Jesus was nailed to that cross because of my sin. What I deserved, he took. And he did it because he loves me. Friends, never, never, never let yourself be convinced of any other truth. The only way to get to God is through Jesus, because he's the only one who paid the price of sin. So Lord, help the thought run deeply in our minds, in our hearts, in our spirit. Father, help us look at it. Help us to see it. Help us to confront the ugly truth that what I deserved, he took. And Father, allow me to feel the weight of that love and the weight of the transfer of that guilt. And let me give you honor and praise, because you're worthy. Because you alone are worthy. And we lift it up in the name of Jesus, who is the only one who makes it possible. And God's people said,